I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Guitar Nerds is sponsored by Music Nomad, our favorite guitar maintenance tool manufacturing masters. You should check them out on musicnomadcare.com or on social media with @musicnomadcare. Hello and welcome to the Guitar Nerds Podcast, the world's number one guitar podcast. I am your host, Joe Branton, joined this week by Matt Knight.
Hello there.
Hello there indeed. Hello, Matt. Hello, dear listener. Welcome back to another episode of the podcast.
The gruesome twosome. Come back to talk about guitar stuff again.
We are. Again. I feel awful, Matt. I stayed in bed right up until you messaged me to start the podcast, more or less. I got up, made myself a little dinner.
And paracetamol and I was going to mix a bunch of medicines there. Not a good idea. Don't listen to that. Paracetamol, plenty of water, and perhaps a vegan sausage roll.
Yeah, very good. Yes. No, I just had a little Kiev thing and some broccoli. That was all I could work out how to do. Just barely here. I've got an alcohol-free beer here now to drink and some water. I didn't think about taking paracetamol and painkillers. I should have done that. I always forget that.
I am definitely one of those people that avoids taking painkillers as much as possible. I don't know. I'm always just like, oh, I've got a headache.
Take the pain.
Yeah, you don't want to get too used to, you know, taking that stuff. Yeah. Apart from, when you're really sick, then it's definitely advisable. That's why, not that this is the health, Joe Branton and Matt Knight's health podcast. I think we could both deal with being a little healthier. CBD gummies. Game changer, Joe. Get into them.
You're big into those, aren't you? You've recommended those to me in the past. Yeah, I tend to do things that have the opposite effect. So, No, that's not what I meant. I meant I take like baobab powder and stuff, like natural energizers and things like that. I had some of that today.
Well, a CBD is technically natural. It's just a bunch of other stuff around it. Most of them are vegan, you know. Good for you, Mr. Branton. Why are you feeling so bad, Joe?
well, obviously, last week when we did the podcast, it was like the day after the Birmingham guitar show. And so I'd had two pretty solid days of being at a guitar show and partying a little bit in the evenings. And then it's been a very full week of work. And then I was straight off again this weekend because it was Portals Festival in London. And dear listener, if you want to experience interesting, weird new music where it could be anything, I thoroughly recommend Portals every year. I mean, yes, fine, my band did get booked, but that's
of course there's not that many bands they can book.
That's true. but it is an excellent weird music festival that takes place at the Tufnell Dome. Three venues there. You get like the Tufnell Dome, the Boston Music Rooms, and they also have a smaller stage at Aces and Eights, which is a lovely little bar just opposite. So it takes place in three venues, which is great. So you can kind of knock between, you know, the main stage at Tufnell Park and then the second room in Boston Music Rooms and Aces and Eights. And there's nothing, the clash times are very well worked out. So you get to see an awful lot of music.
Oh, that's good. So is it all in one venue or is it like kind of like they're very, very close to each other?
Yeah, it's weird to, I guess Tufnell Park and, Tufnell Dome and Boston Music Rooms are technically one building, but they are sort of separated, as it were. So upstairs is the Dome, which is a larger venue. Downstairs is the Boston Music Rooms. And then the other one, Aces and Eights, is literally across a little road outside. So that is a separate... that one's very small. Aces and Eights, you could probably cram 50 people in there. It's very much... used to be the acoustic stage, but they put a lot of full bands on this time round, which I think had its pros and its cons, to be honest. Like, there was a lot of stuff that... it was a festival, and there are a lot of weird bands. And when it's weird bands, that tends to mean that they're playing often smaller venues to smaller crowds. So one of the nice things about something like Paul's is getting to see what these bands can really do when they're given a big, you know, 1,000 cap venue like the Tufnell Dome, or I think the Boston Music Rooms is a sort of 600 cap. So, you know, nice. It's nice to see bands on those larger stages. But if they get Aces and Eights, essentially you're seeing a floor show, you know. And so it's the same thing as if you were, you know, just going to a pub to see them. So you lose that grandeur. So it's a bit of a shame. But, but yeah, it's still the other two venues are still wonderful, and it's lovely to see some of the music there. Obviously, just like any other festival, it was fraught with, you know, cancellations, bands. Not, you know, they weren't able to get over as many bands from the States or from mainland Europe that they would normally get. So, and lots of, you know, it wasn't just that, lots of last minute cancellations due to COVID restrictions and things like that. I mean, yeah, very sadly, the headlining band for one of the days, L1011, had to pull out because they were in a position where, you know, due to, I guess, the rising costs in everything to do with this, they weren't going to make enough money. They'd lost a couple of other tour dates, and they literally weren't going to make enough money to come over from the States to make it worth their while, which was such a shame because they're such a fantastic band, and they're, you know, a decent full-time band. So it's, you know, it sucks when you hear about financial troubles happening with those sort of developed artists, you know, as well as with the smaller ones.
I was going to say, are they a full-time band? Because you know, you see a lot of bands that, yeah, people have full-time jobs, they still go on tour, but, you know, they've got a fallback, like another job. But, yeah, full-time, you know, that's someone's livelihood,
yeah,
you know, isn't it? Yeah. So, yeah, that sucks. So what, you know, I guess, what did they do? You know, do people move up the bill? When did you play, Joe?
They did a bit of moving around of bands, and they got in a couple of last-minute replacements, but obviously not really, you don't get headliners in last minute. So it was, you know, some other bands came in to fill slots earlier on the bill. We were playing the Sunday, the second day. It was a Saturday and Sunday festival. We had the Boston Music Rooms, which is the second, the mid-sized one. Mm-hmm. And we had a 7 p.m. slot. I think there was only one band after us on that stage, so the sort of penultimate headliner on the middle stage, which was a fantastic slot. A little concerned that it was the Sunday, because Portals is also known as being very much a party festival. And so being late on the day on a Sunday, and of course it's, you know, Tufnell Park isn't incredibly connected on the tube. Dear listeners, if you're not familiar with London's layout, it's kind of the real dark end of the Northern Line. So it's, you know, so getting back, you know, the headliners were, I think, were starting at like 10:30, you know, so it was getting back on a Sunday would be a real effort for people. And I think, you know, towards the end, a lot of bands did see a little bit of drop off on the Sunday for people having to make it home. We didn't, which was wonderful. We played to an absolutely packed stage.
That
was
amazing.
It was very, lovely.
I was about to make a joke about, like, did seven people stick around for Polymath? But I'm not like Mark Packham and Jay Cross, you know. I like your band.
Yeah,
exactly. So, no, that's really good. That's, I mean, again, positive after, you know, hear a lot, you know, I've been to a lot of gigs recently, you know, biggest one, yeah, was... Alexandra Palace, Ali Pally, amazing venue, and, you know, first time to be at a gig of that size for, what, you know, 2 years or so, you know, obviously Brixton Academy. So it's really good to go out and see a lot more live music. In some ways, I think it's sort of compressed, 2 years is compressed into the next 3 or 4 months. So there's a lot of people eager. Unfortunately, yeah, Tufnell Park, maybe not perhaps the most well-connected. But yeah, and I guess a lot of other friends of the podcast kind of playing. Alpha Male Tea Party.
Alpha Male Tea Party. Yeah, Last Hyena, who I don't think you've met, Matt, but they are avid listeners of the podcast.
Mm. And also Aiming for Enrique, a band yes. I'm a big fan of for the guitar players Looping Exploits. Amazing on the kind of looper front. He does some great stuff. I think they're a two-piece. But yeah, absolutely amazing. I also noticed on the bill there's a band called Inviolet and a band called No Violet. So right, I don't know how close they were on the bill, but that could be bizarre. And my favourite of all the band names is Asian Death Crustacean.
Yeah, they're really good. I really like that band.
But yeah, so what sort of gear was there, Joe? Can you remember?
Yes, I certainly can. Well, Orange sponsored the festival. Orange, I tell you what, are doing a great job of sponsoring a lot of music events at the moment. Certainly, they sponsored and provided backline for Strange Forms Festival, the Leeds Weird Music Festival that I spoke about a few weeks ago. And they provided the gear for all three stages at Portals as well, which is great because, you know, it's such a good brand to do that sort of thing because it does such, their gear is so hardy, you know, the big sort of 20 mil marine ply. It's exactly what you want. And of course, it means that there'll be, it's kind of, Orange are a great brand to have in place to just get the job done no matter what is required. You know that the heads are going to be Rockverb 50s, a couple of 412s, you know it's going to be an 810, and in this case I think it was their four stroke head.
I was going to say I can't even remember what bass amps they make.
Well, the AD200's the big one for them.
Ah, of course, yeah, the classic.
But, you know, to be honest, like the four-stroke, a solid-state high-wattage head is probably almost a better shout than a valve head, you know, depending on what people are going to be using with it. Like, I've never tried this because I don't play them, but I imagine like a five-string bass or something like that potentially is not so suited to a vintage-sounding valve head. Mm. Whereas, you know, kind of a good kind of full-range-ish solid-state bass head is a bit more all-purpose.
Yeah, I was just actually on their site because I needed reminding. So do the four-stroke, is that the same as the OB1 and the OB300, or is the four-stroke an older thing? So on their website now, they're listing 8200 and then their two crush amps, 25 and 50, and 100, sorry, three crush amps. The Terra Bass, which I still think, I remember when I was playing in a punk band, we were doing a lot of gigs across London, like everyone was using Terra bass heads. Absolute classic. Yeah, and then you've got OB1 500, OB1 300, 8200, and the little bass thing.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Which I don't remember ever coming out. I might have missed it. But yeah, that's like a 500 watt Class D tiny little solid state bass amp.
time has come on this week's podcast to hear some gear. So let's check out some of the complete guitar amplification and effects solutions available from Neural DSP and their plugins. We've teamed up with Neural DSP a bunch over the last year or two. Matt and I are big fans of what they do, and we'd like you to become part of that. So use discount code GUITARNERDS at neuraldsp.com for 30% off, a whopping 30% off any of their plugins. Worth noting, you get a 14-day free trial with any of their plugins with no credit card required. So if you just want to see what all the fuss is about, you've got a whole 2 weeks on them with any of their amps and effects. Now this week I'm checking out the Pliny plugin suite. Pliny is one of the most innovative and refreshing electric guitarists of our generation. His distinct sound combines an unusually wide variety of styles, progressive, fusion and metal, all with impressive fluency and elegance. Neural DSP designed these plug-in amps a bit differently for Pliny. They engineered his dream amps and effects from the ground up to perfectly cover the vast dynamic tonal range that his music requires. These amp designs were then obsessively modelled with extreme accuracy. The result is three refreshingly new amplifiers, a crystal clear clean, a tight and articulate rhythm amp, and a powerful and defined lead amp. Virtual amplifiers that are not only unique but can also excel in their styles. Here's a track I built using only presets from the Pliny suite, and a bit of synth in there and drums. Perfect for elegant soundscape tones, super cleans, and some great 80s lead tones too. neuraldsp.com and use discount code GUITARNERDS at the checkout for 30% off any of their amp and effects plugins.
Yeah, the little bass thing actually has the most in common, I think, with the four stroke. Whilst it's a different, it's class AB in the four stroke and class D obviously in the little bass thing, but in terms of layout and controls, it's the same with sort of the orange side and the black side of the controls. The difference with the four stroke is I think you get like a parametric EQ, like quite a good range of EQ controls plus gain and volume, and it's 300 watts, but because it's class AB, that's very loud indeed.
Wow.
So yeah, that's a good little backline, and a couple of Rockover 50s. I mean, of course, most people are bringing their heads, 90% of bands are only going to be using the cabs, but whether it's cabs or heads, whatever you're using, they're just a it's just a really good company to have kind of backing you up. And it was consistency between stages, because even the little Aces and Eights, had a pair of 412s in there. Yeah. Actually, they had a 410 for bass in there, which was, I think, wise. But, just great to have them on board and a great selection of amps.
So what did you use in the end?
Well, because, it's a festival, isn't it? I'm not going to cart around my entire bass rig for it. So recently I've moved to using a couple of Ashdown ABM 112 cabs. They're their Neo cabs. They're great. They've got a little handle in the top, and you can carry them both, at the same time with the handle in the top, and they're super light. So I'm very happy with those, because it's a big difference from carting around my big cotton wool lined 15s that were in 410 chassis that weighed
love
a ton.
It. Love yeah. it.
It's very nice to have those. And they're great. And to be honest, when I played through those 15s and it's an amp close to the floor, I guess sometimes, you do miss having the tone hitting you at head height or body height, at least. Whereas having the two single 12 stacked now, it's kind of like having a mini 810. almost.
Right.
Yeah. But sorry.
I was going to say, have you? It just reminded me whether we've talked about this on the podcast. So I was in a covers band for a while when I was in like my mid 20s, with most of the people were like 15 to 20 years older than me. But I was like, oh, you know, just play a few gigs and earn a few pence. And I remember the bass player, great guy. He played a five-string Ibanez. But his bass rig, he had I'm pretty sure it was an 18. And then a 15. And then a set of tweeters.
Oh, that is the most 90s rig.
And I was like, I just suddenly thought, I was like, Joe, have you ever considered going for an 18? Can you even buy an 18-inch speaker anymore for bass players?
But not anymore.
So subby. I mean, that's why I always used to love that Mark Bass 2x15.
Yeah,
it's just oomphy.
Yeah, I really like the idea of 2x15s. Actually, I think that's great. I mean, obviously, that's what I had previously, separately in cabs. It's just when you're in a 5-piece that use several tunings, so you have to bring multiple guitars, and there's a sax player, your synth player has 3 keyboards, you know, it starts to become difficult to fill even a long wheelbase transit, which we have. So the move to the 212. So the whole thing with loading up the back of a band van for tours is Tetris. So it doesn't matter that I'm moving from one cab to two. It's actually better because they're smaller and you can get them into little spaces a little bit easier.
Yeah.
So I didn't bring any of those. I just brought my head because recently I've moved to, again, for the reason of portability, I stopped taking out my ABM 600, which is, I still think, you know, I really like the sound of solid state stuff just across the board. I think it's a great solid state head, but it is big. And because it's in its own, you know, sort of like chassis, you can't rack mount it as such. It would need to go into a hard case, which ends up being pretty much twice the size of the head itself. It takes up a lot of room, is what I'm getting at. So right. I moved to this little Ashdown do these original 500s. They've actually discontinued them now, I think, just do the original 300s. So I've got one of the 500s. It's just Class D. It has like a 5-band EQ on it. I leave everything flat. I just use that head for volume, and then I have a preamp on my board. I'm using the Sansamp Bass VT, and using that for everything. That's where all the tone is coming from. And then just a little bit of clean power from the head. Obviously, a bunch of other pedals on the board as well.
Nice.
But yeah, that's the setup. So that was all I had to bring, which was kind of nice.
What about on the guitar front? Because one thing I've noticed from going to a few gigs recently, certainly bigger gigs now, is just how few amps you see on stage at all. Like, I don't know. Yeah, I guess, you know, and, you know, especially where I'm, you know, working and the kind of inquiries I'm getting, like so many people are just being like, we just need to switch out. You know, partly for convenience, partly for just like consistency. I mean, I went to one gig and the support band, quite a small support band, were had the classic backline of like Fender Hot Rod Deluxe. But yeah, I think now as well, just for looks and presence on stage, you just don't see guitar amps on stage at all.
No, and I
wondered if that's really started, you know, whether that's really in your scene or not. A lot of people are still using amps, I guess.
Well, the thing is that my scene is like super broad, you know, that people call it math rock, but it's like we're a prog band, you know, and doom bands get lumped into that if they're weird and interesting. There's a lot of like math rock has got this indie edge to it, so more interesting indie bands might get booked there. So there's a lot of different people at these shows, but crucially that also means like quite a few age groups, and it's interesting seeing how those split up as well, because you're absolutely right, I saw a lot of Helix there.
Right. Interesting.
Well, yes and I think mostly actually around a lot of the younger players, and I think that's probably because excuse me. Oh, I have to cut that.
I've just been a bit sick in my mouth.
I think crucially because Helix is such an accessible price point. You know, I know that you know the Boss GT stuff certainly is as well, but because Helix was there for such a long time, I think at the accessible price point, I think
Well established.
Yes, it's well established, and a lot of people go for it on account of that. So, yeah, saw a surprising amount of Helix and HX Stomp being on boards with a couple of other bits, but no amplifiers, certainly in the younger bands, certainly with the more cleaner, more major scale sort of math indie bands. That was definitely the route that was taken there. And, you know, the younger bands, essentially, which is, of course, where, you know, there was that article that came out recently, I can't remember who printed it, about Fender dominating that festival.
Yeah, we spoke about it a bit a few weeks ago, didn't we? And how, I mean, loads of people have picked up on that recently, and how Fender are certainly dominating sort of newer players or younger players or a more diverse range of players and styles.
Exactly. Whilst Gibson seemed to be doubling down on sort of your classic rock guys, you know, the two companies have never been more different. They're certainly almost carving up different parts of the marketplace for themselves at the moment. And you absolutely saw that. You know, the younger bands largely were using digital stuff. Sorry, were using Fender coupled with digital stuff. There was so much Fender there, of course. Yeah, you know, the band that played after Polymath on the Boston Music Rooms, a band called Boss Keloid, who are more of a sort of Sabbath-inspired doom band. You know, they rocked up. They had a green amp. The other guitarist was playing through a 5150. The bass player actually brought in his whole own rig, including cabs, and it was a big Mesa rig, and they were playing through Hagstrom. There was a Gibson in a chainsaw case, but that was a spare, so I didn't see what came out of that. I think the only things that came in chainsaw cases were Les Pauls. Is that right? Do you know?
I don't remember.
It doesn't matter especially, but, you know, certainly, you know, an older sort of like 90s Gibson there. Hagstrom Viking on the lead guitarist and singer.
Nice.
What was the bass? For some reason, it was a double humbucker Music Man Stingray, but it looked like an older model. And then the other guitarist was actually using a Dunnable. Which was pretty cool. But they had Gibsons there as well as kind of backup guitars, and that was way more. Do you know? Never has there been a sort of age separation of equipment like the sort of plinky plonky Fenders of the young bands and the sort of, you know, high output humbucker loaded Gibson. I know that's almost a bad example. I've said, you know, as a Gibson band, and it's a Dunnable and a Hagstrom, but it's that vibe, it's that feel, it's that look, and it's that sound. And, you know, those two things are very different. I would say the best tone of the entire festival, I actually heard at Aces and Eights, that tiny venue, crammed in. I was right at the front with maybe, you know, 30, 40 other people crammed in there as well. It was a band called Sang Freud, who listener, if you want an exercise in subtle, clever, tasteful, rhythmic work, these guys were it. They reminded me where they have quite a sort of Radiohead meets Portishead vibe to them. And the guitarist, a fellow called Charlie Barnes, plays he has a gorgeous Sunburst Telecaster, which he's put a Strat neck on, and he plays it into a Fender Twin, an old Fender Twin. He's a young fella, you know, he's in his mid-20s, and just his guitar work was incredibly, incredibly tasteful. Using on the floor, had a used reverb on the amplifier of just on all the time. All of his sounds would end up with that. An MXR microamp was the backbone of his sort of coarse cutting tone, but his drive pedal was a Rat.
Nice.
Which
love
I thought
it.
Was great. I loved it. His board was so simple. There were maybe five pedals. It was on like a piece of ply. Like, he didn't even use Velcro. There were like cable ties putting the pedals on, which, you know, normally I'm like, ugh, you need to get your equipment sorted, sir. But he was probably the best guitarist there. Very tasteful and just tonally excellent. And it's just testament to, you know, he probably uses that Rat because it was probably the first distortion pedal he got. But what he gets is the best possible tone because he knows that pedal inside out. And, you know, yeah. I guess it's sort of the opposite of what it's you and the, more me, what we do. I change my board every other gig.
It's the player that makes the gear, exactly. I guess, isn't it? You know, and yeah, I think that's great. You know, in some ways it would be interesting to, and maybe this is a Patreon topic, Joe, I'm thinking off the top of my head, if we had to hit the reset button now, you know, not if we were going in being like, what would our first guitar be? But if we could start again, what would we buy right now? If we've been playing for a while, and where would we go? Would we still have crazy pedal boards? Would we go for something different? I don't know. I guess, you know, there's a lot of really interesting players out there and great players, you know, inspiring a new generation of people, like, you know, like her custom Strat, and guy like thinking people like Corey Wong and stuff like that, you know, that obviously appeal to like real guitarists, you know, like guitarists, I guess, but also, you know, music that's way more accessible. People just going, well, he's not using a bunch of gear. Do you know what I mean? It's just like a clean sound. Yeah. So, I wonder, I think there's more pedals than ever, but I think it's interesting that there's probably a lot of people just going, I don't need that.
iZotope and Native Instruments have teamed up to create the start-to-finish bundle that home recording guitar nerds have been waiting for. Plus, you, dear listener, get an extra 10% off with Guitar Nerds by using discount code NERDS10 at the checkout on iZotope.com. From the creative spark to the final touch, their new bundles include pretty much everything you could possibly need, which is great because it's far too easy to sink hundreds of pounds and a big chunk of your time into just picking up random plugins. The Music Production Suite 4.1 and Complete 13 bundle contains over 30 intelligent mixing, mastering and repair plugins, 65 premium instruments, 20 plus expansions and over 35,000 sounds. And if that's a bit basic for you, they've also bundled Music Production Suite 4.1 with Complete 13 Ultimate, which gives you everything that makes Complete 13 incredible, plus a colossal library of added synths, sampled instruments and effects, 115 plus premium instruments and effects, 39 native instruments expansions and over 65,000 sounds. Whew. It sounds like a lot. It is. It's very good, very comprehensive, and as we've come to expect from iZotope, it's very good value. If you're looking to get into home recording, I cannot recommend it more highly. And if you're already into home recording, it really is the one-stop shop for making what you do sound better. This podcast is entirely treated and produced using iZotope plugins, and Native Instruments have been responsible for almost every synth or sample you've heard on our Guitar Nerds jingles. Check out their great new bundles on iZotope.com or follow links in the description of this podcast and use discount code NERDS10 at the checkout for 10% off anything in the iZotope arsenal.
Oh, it's definitely a trait that I have that I wish I could change. Obviously, it goes hand in hand with doing the jobs that we do. But, you know, I wish I'd just picked one thing, you know, one guitar and, you know, four pedals and just learnt them inside out, and that you know, I wish that's what I was doing.
that is one thing that I've come to sort of realize recently is, you know, having I've been packing a bunch of stuff away and I've kind of gone, right, well, I just need to have, like, you know, my demo pedal board for work and then my bigger pedal board out. They're just too big to put. I can't lift it to put it in the loft anyway. And I'm like, I really need to, like, learn how to use this pedal board and what I can get out of it. Because I think maybe you're the same as me in some ways, Jay. It's like when you can't get something, or you try for 2 minutes to get something out of some of the gear you've got, you go, oh, I need to buy something else. Or I need to buy the pedal that fills that hole, as it were. I mean, I've had like a space on my pedal board before and gone, oh, I really need to put a distortion pedal there. And I've got like 30 and I'm like, yeah, but none of those ones. It's got to be a different one.
That's exactly what I always do. Like, you know, I've got that custom pedalboards.co.uk board and it's fantastic, but it's because it's small, it's wonderfully compact, but it's very specifically designed basically for pedals with in that normal format with top mounted jacks, because otherwise you can't really get anything out of it.
Yeah.
And so I exactly the same. I found myself like a bit, you know, I've said this many times on the podcast, I love my MXR Phase 90, but I was like looking around on the internet being like, maybe I need another phaser with top mounted jacks.
Yeah. Wait,
why am I doing that? Why?
I've done that so many times and gone, oh, you know, I've got like, you know, some great stuff. And I'm like, yeah, but I don't, just not that one. Anything but that one. And I think, you know, we've said it before, but I've kind of like finally settled, and I've kind of changed the layout on my big pedal board a bit, and and I'm like, right, now I just need to learn how to use it.
Oh. Well, there you go. Well, that's exciting. Stick to that, Matt, and do just that.
Yeah, well, maybe I should talk about my little demo pedal board for work then.
Yes, let's do it.
So I've kind of, you know, obviously if I'm going to go out and about or show staff anything, you know, can't really, you know, it's got to be an all boss pedal board, which, you know, is no problem for me in general, but I was like, need to put together one that not only fits my musical style and taste, but I guess is also something that I could demo, you know, some potential on, you know, a wide range of different things, and of course it all be boss stuff. So what I've done, oh, it's an angry dog outside. What I've done is I've built a pedal board around some of the new stuff, but okay, also some classics. So what I've got, EV1WL. So that's
how many pedals on this board?
Okay, 4, 5, 6 pedals that make sound, and right, 2 pedals that are control, utility, I guess.
What board did you go for first?
So I'm using, of course, I have to use, or I am using some Boss stuff. So BCB 1000. That's our nice little wheelie suitcase pedal board.
That's the coolest board. Like, it's such a good idea. And I find it weird that it's Boss that thought of it in many ways. Like, why isn't this something other people have thought of? It's an excellent way to carry boards. I know that is how you carry like things like the Pedal Train Pro. It has wheels on it and a handle at the top, but doing this on a smaller pedal board is an excellent idea.
Yeah, so, and I think the thing I like about the BCB is that obviously it's a nice rigid metal like actual board that then comes off. It screws into the bottom, so it comes off and you can put everything underneath it.
Oh, I all see. The cables, so it doesn't work like the 30 or the 90.
No, it's totally different. So it's kind of like a Samsonite suitcase, if you will.
I see.
And then, yeah, you take the lid off and then it's the board is in there already. There's no power supply included, but you can put a power supply underneath. And then it's like a metal frame board that you can take out, so you can tie all the cables and everything neatly underneath and
make it
look nice and pro. But it's designed to fit on the majority of like airline carriage specifications in terms of size.
Right.
So you can kind of, you know, it's easier for touring and stuff like that. So I'm using that, and that's one of my favourite boards. It's great, it's sturdy, it's on wheels, I can wheel it places, I don't have to like worry about things being too heavy and carry it around. So I'm using a GT1000 core as the controller. I guess that's what's doing most of the effects, delays and reverbs, apart from a couple, which I'll talk about in a second. But most of the like signal chainy stuff, I guess. So the guitar goes in.
So is that you're using the MIDI function?
I am using MIDI functions as well. It's a kind of real mixed bag, but it seems to work. Gave it a bit of a test drive this afternoon. Seems to work really well. So the guitar actually goes into the SY200 first. And then what I've done is I split the signal. So I go out of the output, and then I also go out of the effects loop send, and you can wire the SY200 inside for like direct. So you can kind of effectively run like a parallel chain, I guess.
I see.
So you can run dry signal and then an affected signal. The output, the dry side, goes into the standard input of the GT1000, and then the affected side goes into the effects loop return of the GT1000. Right?
I see. Okay.
So you can then inside the GT1000 split the outputs, So you've got a left and a right output. And then you can... So what I do is I split the outputs so they're like not stereo, effectively. So you've now got a signal path that goes in and then goes to two separate outputs, and they're totally independent. And then what I do is I put the effects loop two, or the effects loop that the SY-200 goes into the right output. So the guitar signal comes in, but the effects loop two only goes out of one output.
Ah, very clever.
So you're kind of like, you effectively split the signal, and then because you place the effects loop right at the end of the signal chain, before the output, you get just the synth sound out of one output, and you get the dry out of the other. But then,
where do you send the synth sound in that case?
Well, actually, I'm running both outputs, and this is going to sound stupid, but it definitely makes sense if you're running bigger rigs. But I actually run both inputs into a JC40, and the reason I do it is because I just wanted more dry sound,
yeah,
underneath the SY 200, and I wanted the ability to add synth sound. Originally, what I was doing was looping. I wanted to affect the SY200 separately and then it not be so muddy between a stereo setup.
I see.
Rather than everything having reverb on it, what I wanted was like a really cavernous reverb just on the synth sound. But then obviously you've got a dry output, so you're getting a more straight ahead dry sound, if that makes sense. And then I realized by running that signal chain, if you've got the effects loop two going straight into one of the outputs, you can actually then put effects in between that. So then I'm like, oh, I can have delays and reverbs switch on and off just to affect the synth output.
Very cool. So what are you doing in terms of that then?
Guitar Nerds are teaming up with Music Nomad, and I really think, nerds, you need to check out musicnomadcare.com. We've spoken about all their wonderful guitar maintenance products on the podcast, and I really can't emphasize how important it is to look after your gear and how easy Music Nomad make that for you with things like their how-to advice center and their setup hub. Music Nomad have been around for a little over 10 years, and in that time they've become one of the most recognized brands for guitar tech gear. They're available worldwide in every guitar store you can think to name, and it's for a good reason. All their products are professional grade quality. Every tool and even the cases the tools come in are designed for proper, rugged, on the road use. Make sure you check out what all the buzz is around Music Nomad, as they are redefining and raising the bar for equipment care. Learn more at musicnomadcare.com or follow them on social media with @musicnomadcare.
Well, so I'm using mixture between different patches, but then I was like, I need to put some other pedals on here just to fill out the pedal board space. So what I am doing is then running both outputs, so the synth output and the guitar output, into an RE2, so they can both be affected by space echo, but only the synth sound then goes into an RV6, which I might change into like a DC2W for like a big chorus sound. So you've got like synth and chorus.
Do you get two ins on an RE2?
You do, stereo in and stereo out. And the signal chain runs like stereo in, stereo out. And then I run into a looper. And then in the other effects loop, I'm running a JB2. And then I'm using the GT1000 to switch between the two modes. So you've then got two distortions, you know, but coming from one pedal, which is quite cool. And then I'm using an EV1, which is our wireless MIDI foot controller, although it's got a MIDI out, but it's like a MIDI foot controller into the GT1000. So now I've got like expression control over the SY200 and the GT1000. And it's a kind of just like, again, coming back to that, like learning how to use it, but it effectively allows me to split a synth sound and a guitar sound. And because you've got stereo in on the looper and it's stereo out, you know, they are discrete pathways. When you're running two speakers either side, you can kind of loop this big cavernous synthy sound and then play over the top of it without all of it just like mushing into one mono output.
Well, this sounds like the perfect thing to couple with that cab that you recently purchased, the Zilla cab with two separate, two independent inputs for each speaker.
Yes. So, well, it was a tiny modification, but yes, there's effectively We talked about it maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago, but effectively I needed to shorten down the stuff that I've got here, I guess, for the time being. And as I said before, love the two 112s in the mini stack, but they're closed back. The top speaker is very punchy, especially when you're using it at home, mixed with the other cab that I had, which was an oversized 112, which was open back with a big speaker. They just didn't work together at all. They had this really, especially next to each other, just a really direct speaker and then a much more like open, airy speaker. And right. I just never could get those two amps to just sit well with those two speaker cabs. I tried two amps into the two 112s, you know, the mini stack. And again, the top speaker is just too direct when you're using it at home. So I was like, what I need is a 2x12. And what I'll do is I'll set it up. So rather than them running in series, one speaker into another, that they've both just got their own speaker jack on the back. And just so happens that I've managed to find someone in London on Reverb selling a Zilla 2x12 and it's effectively like a mini 4x12. So you've got two 12s that are diagonal rather than one on top of the other. So you've got a bit more spread. Put two similar speakers in there, or similar power handling speakers. And then wired the backplate up so it's got a speaker input for both speakers. So if you've got a head that's got two speaker outs, you can still run both, or you can still chain them together if you wanted to, using like a Palmer speaker box. But it allows me to run two heads into one cab, but they're running on their own independent speakers. And I guess you'd kind of say, like, why would you do that? And like I said, I think a few weeks ago, that pedal show had actually done the same thing. And I was actually talking to Mick and Dan about it by complete coincidence, that we'd happen to do things on parallel and then I'd saw their video. But part of it is just, again, it just allows the dry signal to cut through a little bit more, but have a slightly more modulated reverb heavy or delay heavy wet signal. And then still just like have your guitar cut through a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally get that. It means that you can make the craziest stuff more crazy without really losing the foundation of what you're playing.
Yeah.
It's very useful. I don't know why that sort of thing isn't just a switch on all two speaker cabs.
Yeah, there must be a way to do it. I'm sure there must probably,
I just think
because
it would
someone
be more
wouldn't...
standard, you know, than the occasional mod that people do.
Yes.
Because it's a great way of being able to use a dual rig without having to take two cabs.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, the cab looks, although there's a real odd colour mismatch, which annoys me slightly, is that there's a blonde cab with a brown front, and then I've got a pink amp, and then like a more kind of, I don't even know what pit Morgan amps call their colour, but I'm like, I really don't match in colour.
You've got like, it's like a sort of a tawny grey.
Yeah, it's kind of like a Voxy kind of, tawny sort of thing. But anyway, you know, looks aside, I'll deal with it. But it makes a big difference. And actually, as soon as I plugged it in and I got my pedal board, well, actually, even without the pedal board, I just went guitar into a Layla P split. And the reason I did that is because you still have to make sure that when you're coming out into two amps, that the two amps are running in phase, because you could still have those two speakers out of phase. Right. But just straight in, I was like, instantly, it just clicked. And I was like, yep, that is the sound. That's what I wanted. You know, the 212 is semi-open back, so it's got the airiness. Two speakers, two high-power speakers, loads of headroom, super clean. It just works. It just sounds better. And I'm like, I love the other cabs that I've got, and I think Zilla still makes some of the best cabs out there. The issue is you've just really got to, if you're going for two cabs, two speakers, or two amps on stage, you've got to match the cabs. I think you've got to have like similar cabs or a similar setup in some ways. Otherwise, it just doesn't work.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, you could pair a Fender and a Marshall. But I think, you know, you'd want two combos. You wouldn't necessarily want a 4x12 and then a twin. I'm sure people have done that to great results, and maybe when you turn it up a bit more. But I just find that, you know, two similar cabs always sound best, in my opinion.
Yeah, you're probably almost definitely right. But,
And maybe, yeah, maybe the same for bass stuff as well, perhaps, but...
Well, there is that thing, isn't it? There was, I think, the late 90s, early 2000s, you saw lots of bass players going for a 410 and a 115. That seemed to be the sort of stack rig of choice, almost. The sort of the compact version of lugging around an 810 was those two combos. I've heard people say that, you know, that people argue that the response is different between a 10 and a 15, so it creates a sort of, you know, a little an issue there. I'm sure that, you know, when you're stacking that rig up in the Dog and Duck and playing over the jukebox, it probably doesn't matter, you know. So I don't know. But certainly I never really cared about that sort of combination. I've always found tens to be just a little bit toppy, I guess, a little bit bright and trebly on bass. That said, I've always got on well with 810s, so I don't know if that's the amount of... I have no idea, dear listener, why that is the case. But yeah, never 100% got on with a 410, but then I don't think I've ever really owned one. Always gone for 15s and 12s, so it's probably just more my ears adjusting to a particular type of thing.
And I think, to be honest, when I'm at home, and I'm sure this is the same for most people, and probably why, you know, a lot of, you know, real guitar nuts who are kind of maybe not doing it as a full-time job but more as a hobby tend to have more stuff, like we were talking about earlier, just because you critique it more, because you're perhaps you're sat in front of it at moderate volumes, or, you know, low to moderate volumes, going, oh, not so sure, and you're always just like, maybe I could get this and it would change it and stuff like that. I think, like you say, if you're maybe using it in anger a bit more,
well, yeah,
you're kind of hearing it in a different way and you're going, yeah, it sounds great. I don't know.
I think I've said it before on the podcast, but I feel totally conflicted between these two almost juxtapositioning parts of my love of equipment. And that's the guitar nerd's me versus the gigging musician version of me, where, you know, the guitar nerd's me wants to have all the stuff and, I don't know, you know, use an Alder & Ash pedal board with, you know, the lovely, lovely wood and loads of pedals and complicated switching. But when it actually comes down to a gig, what I need is something that is as rugged as possible. And so a wooden bass pedal board is not the solution I'm looking for. You know, I need, you know, and it could be, I pick pedal boards then, but it could have been anything. The fact is that despite all the stuff that I buy, and I know this is a well-trodden topic, I still play the same jazz bass that I've played for,
yeah,
you know, whatever, 10, 15, as long as we've done this podcast, I've owned that bass and it's always been sort of the main one. And I've obviously, you know, it's very well documented. I've had lots of other things, bought other things and claimed that they were going to take over, and ultimately they never had. And I mean, this at Portals, when we were at Portals, we often get it, but, you know, some people came to the front whilst we were setting up or packing down, one of the two, to, you know, have a little look at our pedal boards and take a photo. And one fella in particular came over to look at mine, and he was like, oh, I thought there'd be more, because my board is actually, there's a space on my pedal board, for goodness sake. I haven't even filled it, like, since we played the last show, and I had that issue with a power supply. So I sort of cut down my pedals just to the bare bones, because I knew I didn't have any tours coming up. It was only festival shows, and you don't really get sound checks at those. So I just need to know that board's going to turn on and function properly. So it's just it's a Boss BC 1X compressor, an MS3. I've got the Fuzzrocious Little Fella drive. I've absolutely fallen in love with that drive. And the Sans amp that it runs out into, and that is your lot. There's obviously a tuner on there. I used the little TC Noir. I can't remember what it's called, their one. But I used their little tuner, and obviously there's that little FS7 foot switch to help control the MS3. Mm-hmm. And that is everything I've got on my board, you know, other than the power supply. It's incredibly minimal and obviously has a load of gaps on there as well. So, but then, you know, that almost is testament to everything that the MS3 does, because one of the sounds I use the most is ring mod. And I don't know, if you think of all the very expensive ring mod pedals there are out there, I'm still using the MS3 ring mod function.
Yeah, I think just coming back to, like, sometimes, you know, I must admit, as much as I tend to hate to admit it, like, plugging in this pedal board this afternoon, I'm just like, yeah, it's got less on it, but I love the sound straight away. And I'm like, and I was like, oh man, I should have put the SY200 on my big board and stuff like that. And you know, you always just like, you find a sound and then you're like, oh man, I just want to use it. Or like, I just tend to find now that I've got this smaller Boss board, I'm like, actually it's slightly more enjoyable because it's a couple of single pedals and a GT1000 doing a few things I need. And I just sit and play it more. Like the amount of times I plug in my big pedal board and I'm just like messing around with it so much. I'll spend an hour creating like one like patch on the ES8 with everything plugged in. I'm like, I've just wasted an hour. Like I could have actually like made some music at this point. And that's what I actually, sometimes I like about, you know, plugging in some simpler boards. And I, when hopefully, in the not too distant future, we're thinking about moving house, and when I've maybe got a bit more space, I think I'd like to challenge myself just being like, no pedal boards. You just pick a couple of pedals out of the cupboard, as it were,
Matt.
And just go, right, what am I playing with today?
You know, you're getting older when you're starting to rely less on a pedal board.
I know, it's terrible. Bloody terrible.
but you know, I'm feeling very inspired by seeing Sang Freud and you know, just the simplicity of that setup. I mean, for a start, I think I do have a rat somewhere. I assume I do. But I'll probably buy another one. Oh, that's the opposite of what I'm talking about. See, it's inevitably gonna happen. I'm gonna have to hunt down a type of rat. But I've never really cared about the rat. Even when it was the year of the rat last year, I was like, this is fine. They're just, you know, I just have never really got on with them tonally. But hearing them coupled with a Telecaster and a twin and sort of played in that sort of Johnny Greenwood-esque style, I was like, this is the coolest sound I've ever heard. I'm going to be inspired to do that. We'll see.
Nice.
One piece of gear that I did find very useful that I used to port was this. This might be getting a bit boring, a bit dull, dear listener. As a topic, or it might seem very obvious to you, but I do a lot of switching between playing with a pick and fingerstyle. And you know, we don't. I know I have a mic for talkback, but because it's an instrumental band, I'm not really near a mic often enough to use any of those sort of mic-mounted plectrum holders. So I use the top of my scratch plate on the jazz bass. And I fit it in there. It kind of limits me to basses with scratch plates. You know, it's one of the reasons I've always kept the jazz, because that you get used to that motion of, like, you know, of grabbing the plectrum from there and being able to put it back quickly and move back to fingerstyle. And I love playing my 50s reissue P bass, but of course it has a gold anodized scratch plate on it. There's no wiggle room on those plates, so there's no way I can get a little plectrum in there. But I know that, dear listener, there are solutions for this. In, like, you know, I remember when Total Guitar used to sell those plectrum holders with sticky backs that you could put on your guitar or something. I know Tom Peters from Alpha Male Teapot, he uses them. I just think they look terrible. This weird plastic block stuck on your guitar, it's just awful. But yeah, so I needed a solution. And when we were at the Birmingham Guitar Show, I went over to see the wonderful James at James's Home of Tone. He, of course, had some right-on straps, which is another thing for me. I don't want to buy straps made out of meat products at all. So finding like a vegan strap is tricky when I also wear my bass under my chin. It means I have to get something that goes down to 34 inches, which is not that common. Often they won't do that. And you know, like the sort of wider, they're generally wide sort of leather straps that have the separate sort of buckled bit that you, I don't know how to describe them. You know what I mean, Matt?
I know what you mean.
Straps. Yeah, those things. They never go short enough. I love the look of those. I can never get anything short enough. Anyway, right on straps do a, it is a conventional sort of belt style strap, but it does go down to 34 inches. So that was, I was excited by that. It's a vegan strap company. They had some great designs. It was this lovely sort of imitation suede on the underside with this cool, you know, sort of Spanish style pattern on the front of the strap. Very tasteful, all browns and golds, right up my street. I was really into it. And so I got that, picked that up from James's stand. And the thing that I never really considered when I looked at it, but it has a little plectrum holder on the yep. end of the strap.
Yeah, because I've got one. I've got a black and orange. Really good straps. But yeah, nice little cheeky plectrum holder there. Probably most people would just leave one in there and forget about it, but you're actually going to use it in real time.
Yeah. Which I have been. I still use the jazz bass, admittedly, for the show that we played, but at rehearsals leading up to it, I took my P bass last week, and I was just getting used to the motion of it being in a slightly different place, like the plectrum being up on the strap end instead of under the plate, because I have to do it quite quickly sometimes. But it's not too different, to be honest, because of, I guess, of how high I wear my strap. That those two points are quite close together. And it's great. It's a great idea. It's actually a really good solution. And I'm sure, you know, I'm not the only person that, you know, plenty of guitarists finger pick all the time. And I know you guys can generally cup a plectrum in your idle two fingers when finger picking, and then sort of move back to it. That you know, that's not something I can do because of, I guess, the way you play bass finger style to plectrum style doesn't work out. But it's very useful. It's such a boring standard thing, but I'm like, this is actually really handy. This is a really good idea.
I wasn't sure if you're gonna say, or I was gonna say, because you play the bass so high, rest it on your chin, or your chin rests on the bass, should we say, that you just keep one in your mouth, and then when you need it, you sort of just like slowly spit it out and then grab hold of it. That would be far more impressive.
Matt, that was not too far from what I used to do, and there is a good reason that I stopped. I used to keep plectrums in my mouth when I play and switch between them that way. The reason I don't is because I'm not as fit as I used to be, and I am, generally speaking, with the amount that I throw myself around live, I am pretty out of breath a couple of songs in. And we did it once, and I got so out of breath that I sort of took a deep breath.
Oh, I've done that. I've done that.
And the plectrum went right into my mouth, and I nearly swallowed it and choked on it.
No, so I actually did do that and swallowed a pick and then had to be sick.
You swallowed a plectrum? How does that even work? How do you fit a plectrum down your throat?
Well, I was using Jazz 3s at the time, so.
Matt, that is awful. Did you get it back up?
I did. I had to admit, I did. It came out the same way it went in.
I'm so glad it did.
But yeah, that's why after that point, never put a pick in the mouth again.
That is hilarious.
So yeah, so right on straps, much better for that, because you can just put it in the little pick holder.
Exactly. Exactly.
But yeah, that is definitely, someone obviously thought of that when they were making that strap, going, we could tack a little pick holder on there. Someone will use it for the right reason. And there you go.
But they are really lovely right on straps.
They're great. They're great straps.
Check out their website, dear listener. They do an awful lot of stuff like conventional, subtle straps, like simple things. But they also do like, you know, interesting pattern strap. They do those wider straps with the sort of latching. Well, I can't think of how to describe these straps, dear listener, but you know, they do the wider strap with the sort of buckle based latching, and they do the more normal strap thing as well. There's lots of cool stuff on there and lots of great designs. There are actually some ukulele straps on here that I'm looking at now. That
do you even own a ukulele?
No. Ukulele straps are short enough for me to wear.
Of course. Ukulele or crazy bass player straps. Yeah.
exactly. So yeah, we'll see. I might invest in some more, seeing as this is a solution to me playing more stuff. Now we are running short on time.
I put a new story in here, Joe, which I think would make a good Patreon topic. Mm-hmm. About for listeners, maybe the main one we should mention what that is, but maybe talk about this something that doesn't really happen in the UK, which is someone found a 1960 Les Paul in their cupboard.
Yeah, that is much rarer over here than I think it is in the States. So yeah, that's definitely worth a discussion in a few weeks. We're still pinning down the final dates, but in a few weeks, dear listener, we're going to be joined by Joel from Chase Bliss to talk about The Habit.
Yeah, we should maybe we should dedicate a few minutes talking about this, because I don't know if we talked about it. Maybe it came out when I wasn't on a pod, or maybe you talked about it otherwise. But
I think initially I held off talking about it because, you know, we were looking forward to getting Joel on the podcast. Just our calendars sort of haven't quite aligned for the last couple of months almost now. So, you know, so it's worth actually talking about it.
Well, I don't really know how you describe it. I mean, they say habit is a delay with a memory. They basically sold it to me when they went 60 seconds of delay. We've tossed a whole lot of echo into the habit. Frippertronics. And then I just sort of like fuzzed out from that point. I was like, oh, that sounds great. But effectively, a really long delay pedal. It's a digital delay pedal, I guess you would say, that has a kind of analog feel and modulation to it, that constantly remembers everything that you feed into it up to, I think, something like 3 minutes. Is that right? Or did I make that up? I think that's right.
So,
it effectively has a recording function that's always on. And at any point, you can just tell it to start playing back something it's recorded in that time. And then you can kind of manipulate it in various ways, which is just really unique and really cool. I mean, you know, we're at the point now where I can't think of a genuinely like new effect that doesn't exist, I guess, if you know what I mean. Like everything is a take on something else. And to kind of look at it and go, you know, they already make the tonal recall, it's a fully analog delay with digital control. You know, they've had great success with the mood and the blooper being their kind of crazy looper with loads of mods in it, their mood being the kind of collaboration between Drolo effects and Old Blood Noise. So you've got kind of a reverb delay and then like a short looper on there. This is kind of more of a digital delay that takes elements of both, I guess, but gives you a kind of everything from a real crazy looping delay to, you know, even a kind of more classic like multi-tap delay.
Yeah.
But I just love the fact that it always records. You can, at any point, you can, as they say, you can scan back into the history and play moments from the past, which I like. I think just a great idea of... I could definitely see me using this, because I was like, oh, it'd be a great delay, I guess. But actually, in some ways, just using it as something of an ideas machine, you know. Yeah. Or,
well, that's what they refer to it as, a musical sketch pad, a compositional delay.
Yeah,
that's what they call it. And I totally agree. I love that they managed to do all of that with rotary controls. So if, you know, like me, dear listener, you're finding everything that Matt's saying a little bit intimidating about the habit, and certainly I have in the past, and it's probably why I've never owned a Chase Bliss pedal, is how intimidatingly complex they sound. The fact that they managed to keep it all, you know, across six rotary controls and a handful of switches is very impressive.
Yeah, I think, you know, really hands-on, really creative, really tactile, I guess, is, you know, what I would say. Is it's like, you know, something like the habit, I feel that you could dive into really easily, and sure, it might make a bunch of bleeps and bloops, which, you know, I'm certainly into, as are a lot of other people, but it's like, yeah, you can just kind of, you know, just plug it in, and I think it would create a lot of cool stuff and cool ideas. Definitely is like an inspiration machine, because I, you know, I've been using the Microcosm a lot from Hologram Electronics, and it's very much like an expanse on the kind of things that maybe the mood can do, but it does lack a few things. I mean, again, probably just need to sit down and actually use it in a bit more detail, but this, I feel that I could have this on the board at the same time and it would do anything from like delays and stuff like that, but certainly coming back to stuff that you've recorded and then kind of using that as a, I guess, like a sample generator. You know, one thing I've always thought is quite cool for pedal boards is like having like, you know, having a looper on your pedal board that's got a load of pre-recorded loops. I know I think, did you used to do that in Polymath with the old Digitech Jam Man back in the day?
Yeah, we used to use the Jam. Jam Man was the second iteration. It all used to be done on an Akai Headrush before, and then a Jam Man stereo after that.
Yeah, so I always like the idea of having that sort of stuff in there. But I certainly like the idea of a 60-second delay. I think that is very, very cool.
I will say also, I did a very Matt Knight thing with the habit. I checked out the manual.
Yes, that came with it.
And the manual is excellent. Chase Bliss manuals generally are, but it's like they understand that this is daunting and complex. And so their way of teaching you how to use the pedal is very organic. It doesn't just give you 8 pages telling you every single thing that each control does individually. It allows you to learn the pedal in a very hands-on, real-time, using everything at once fashion. So it will give you presets. It will say, you know, put the 6 rotary controls here and the 3 little switches in this order. This gives you this type of sound. Now simply use this control to modify it through these parameters. And you do that and you're like, oh right, you understand what that individual control is doing and how it's affecting the rest of the pedal. And then, you know, it'll ask you to do that again with a handful of different presets, so you get used to how each control can impact the rest of the pedal. It's very good, very well thought out. I mean, you know, just a lot of work had obviously gone into the manual as well, and just excellent tutoring, I thought, by Chase Bliss.
Yeah, I think, again, another success hit. And I look forward to having Joel and Nobs on the podcast real soon to talk about the idea. I think Scott, who is Nobs, the YouTube channel, kind of the inspiration for so many other pedal demos out there. And, you know, great kind of trendsetter for the look and feel of so many pedal demos.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, he's now part of their like product design team. So he kind of really comes up with the ideas and helps, you know, work and create these things. And I think, they've both done a fantastic, fantastic job.
Indeed they have. Well, that, dear listener, brings us up to the end of this week's episode. You can, of course, join us over on Patreon at patreon.com/guitar nerds. We're going to be talking about this 1960 Gibson Les Paul that was found in a cupboard, and I don't know, maybe the fact that I threw up on myself in an Uber.
Which one's more interesting for guitarists? I think it's probably Joe Branton in a taxi.
You can become a Patreon supporter for as little as $1 a month. At the dollar tier, you get this episode ad-free and early every week. $5 gets you access to our Patreon special and our back catalogue. $10 gets you the lot. Plus, I'll sing you my thanks at the end of every episode. Find us on all your favourite social media platforms and join the Guitar Nerds group on Facebook to get involved in our weekly episode discussion. Thanks for listening. You've been lovely. We've been the Guitar Nerds. Farewell.
Goodbye.
Scott, Harding, Jack, Cumberland, and more. Yeah.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. Make a bigger impact at work with Grammarly. Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. You can even save time by going from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds. Join the 96% of Grammarly users that say it helps them craft more impactful writing. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.